Welcome to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. I'm your host, Brooke Bagby. In here, the results are always positive. We explore the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. Whether you are driving across the country or listening on the web while you're working on your favorite project, you are about to learn more about who we are, why we are here, and what we may become if you thought possible. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You will be safely traveling with us. Keep your arms inside the vehicle, recline your chair, look out the window as we launch X Squared Radio. Did you know you have existed for many thousands of years? The thought of reincarnation escapes most people, as it did me until I read this book. Your Never-Ending Life is the first in the Universal Learning Series from Sandy Andrews. Search your higher mind, find your soulmate, and know that you are never alone in this world. The treasures of the eternities are yours, and your first step is to read the book. Click the banner for Your Never-Ending Life by Sandy Andrews at X Squared Radio and order the book today. The foundations of religion and science were used to restore knowledge lost for over 6,000 years in our first book. The Ark of Millions of Years, Volume 2, called 2012 and Harvest of the End Times, brings us vital knowledge for the race of mankind. Have the Watchers returned? What did the Aztecs mean by their ancient predictions for the year 2012? Why is Earth changing so rapidly now before our very eyes? Who were the Shining Ones who lived on the Earth and worked with mankind as they recovered from cataclysm? Who are we? Where did we come from? If you could find a book that answers just one of these questions, you'd buy it. Now there are two in the series that is sweeping the world with its message. Go to arcofmillionsofyears.com and get your autographed copy today. Now, also available in full audio version. And greetings, Earth Explorers. Welcome to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. We're coming to you live from deep beneath the Earth in western Kentucky. Tonight, the solar wind is a mere 548 kilometers per second, and the Earth is sitting in the flow of a coronal hole. If there was a chance for an aurora borealis, this would be the night. By the way, did you happen to get out last night and see the spectacular Venus next to the fingernail moon? Wow. Now that was a sight. Absolutely beautiful. Get out tonight after the program and look in the western sky for Venus. It might not be lined up with the moon like last night, but it was really beautiful anyway. By the way, tonight there are 862 potentially hazardous asteroids in the vicinity of Earth. If you happen to pick one up headed our way, you will give us a call, won't you? The new 31-minute version of the Inner Earth Expedition video is now complete and for sale. This includes the Tibetan footage. This film includes things you will never see on any other channel. Now, we have set a goal to sell a few of these, so if you have it, buy one for a friend. If they like it, when they have time to buy, get one for a friend as well. Every penny goes towards the efforts to complete the North Pole expedition next year. This is a way everyone can participate and get something really great to watch. This is really a great documentary. Also, we will be at Mount Shasta the 9th of June to put on a workshop called The Physics of the Soul and Time Travel with Shalimar Productions. Check it out at our page at x2-radio.com or on bbsradio.com at the X Squared Radio website. This is a six-hour workshop that will change your life. If you can't make it, though, don't worry too much. You'll be able to view it via StreamLink live as an archive for only $19.95. We are doing everything we can to get this information into your hands, so don't miss this opportunity. By the way, Walter Wally Schirra, one of the first seven original American astronauts and the only one to fly Mercury, Gemini, and Apollo missions, passed away two Wednesdays ago after having been hospitalized for cancer. The U.S. Air Force awarded a contract modification to Lockheed Martin Space Systems worth $35.8 million to address issues with the space-based infrared system, high missile warning satellite program, according to a Pentagon contract announcement dated May 3rd. Our solar system is actually hurtling through space while angled nearly perpendicular to the plane of the Milky Way, new computer models suggest. It's almost like we're sailing through the galaxy sideways, said study team leader Mirav Ofer, an astrophysicist at George Mason University in Virginia. The findings, detailed in the May 11th issue of the Journal of Science, suggest the magnetic field in the galactic environment surrounding our solar system is pitched at a sharp angle and not oriented parallel to the plane of the Milky Way, as previously thought. Imagine that. Astrophysicists were wrong. Last week, I was speaking in Hawaii at the Earth Transformation Conference hosted by Michael Sala and Angelica Whitecliffe. All I can say is fantastic. The speakers were all enormous, starting out with Len Horowitz and filled with great speakers all weekend. You need to set aside a date for next May to go to Hawaii to be at that conference. It's one of the best in the world. I guarantee it. Next week, we'll have one of the Disclosure Project witnesses coming on the program, Dan Willis. He will stun you with his UFO evidence and who he knows. Stephen Greer started the movement that is destined to change the world. This is one of the men who added weight to the testimony. You don't want to miss this program. And a possibility that we might have David Icke on next week. We shared an hour with Juliet last hour, and it was incredible. We're going to go deep into the details of a subject that rarely makes it to this program tonight. And many people wonder about the idea of reincarnation. What is really there? Who has done any kind of study? Well, two men have done it. Our first guest tonight wrote a book called The Reincarnation of Abraham Lincoln. The details in this book are astounding. We'll cover what we can in 1 hour with Richard Salva. In our second hour, we will have Jeffrey Keane. He wrote a book called Somebody Else's Yesterday. This is the story of an amazing journey, an adventure through the eyes of two people, one a Georgian and the other a Connecticut Yankee. Similarities between the two go far beyond coincidence. I think you'll like it. They think alike, look alike, and even share facial scars. Their lives are so intertwined that they appear to be one. Our first hour tonight, and we only have a two-hour program tonight because we shared an hour with Julia with David Icke. Hopefully we'll return the favor next week and have David Icke on for an hour on X Squared Radio. We have a lot of questions we want to ask him, and I know you did too. So we're going to welcome Richard Salva. Richard, are you there?
Yes. Hi, Brooks. Pleasure to be here.
Oh, Excellent, excellent. I've been reading your book the past week, and I usually start out at the beginning because this program is where the past meets the future. But because we only have 1 hour, I would like to start out with some amazing insights that you bring up in your book. The first is where you state, when we leave our physical bodies at death, who we are remains much the same. Our spirits, temporarily freed from physical limitations, expand somewhat in the astral world, yet our thoughts, habits, and emotions endure. And when we return to Earth, we carry them with us into our new bodies. Now, I found that very, very profound, and I have several questions for you.
Yes.
The first is about the lessons and experiences from a full mortal life. I assume that we are timeless, or at least ancient beings with thousands and perhaps millions of existences to our name. How do the pains and joys of a mortal life change the spirit of the person from life to life?
Well, through our various experiences in life, we learn important lessons in life. Now, often we don't learn them all in one lifetime. We're lucky if we learn one or two really important lessons in a single lifetime. We spend so much time in our lives just putting food on the table, trying to meet the person we're going to end up with, or persons, if it doesn't end up just being one. And we don't really end up spending that much time dealing with the moral and spiritual lessons. But these life lessons pursue us nonetheless. And often it takes time to really perfect something. It's like the analogy that I like to use is of a Major League Baseball pitcher. And during spring training, he's up there and he just keeps pitching over and over again. He's trying to paint the outside part of the plate. And it takes time for him to develop it until it becomes habitual, where every time he can get that last call, strike three on the batter. And for us, too, it takes time. It takes repeated experiences. We have to experience something a number of times before we have been able to react to it in such a way that we've really mastered that experience. And so we attract these experiences over and over again until we reach a point, like I say, where we're able to relate to it from the highest octave of our being. At the beginning of the reincarnational cycle, we act, one might say, like an animal. And at the end of it, we behave more like an angel. But it takes a long, long period of time for this process to happen. You know, in evolution and nature, scientists tell us that it takes millions of years for these slow, gradual changes to take place. And this is an analogy for what happens on the spiritual level through reincarnation. Just slowly by slowly, as they say in India, over long stretches of time, we learn all of these really important lessons.
Well, do you think that possibly we reach a lifetime where we become aware rather early in life and we make great strides in our consciousness in a single lifetime and maybe not just incrementally over hundreds of lifetimes?
Well, for anyone who exhibits such a great leap, it's because they have made slow progress over other lifetimes. It is a slow process. Anyone, like I said, people point out people like the Buddha or so on that didn't have a spiritual teacher, didn't have that much spiritual training, but made this incredible progress in his life. But that demonstrates, and he mentioned that himself, that he had lived all these lifetimes where he had learned the lessons that sort of prompted him and set him up so that he could manifest such wisdom and such spiritual maturity.
What about our loves and our fears? Do those carry forward to the next life?
Yes, yes, it's true. That's one of the largest lessons in life, is to learn to be able to love unconditionally. And as we were saying before, experience is the greatest teacher. It's really the only teacher. How many of us are really willing to take somebody else's word for something? Often we just say, well, that may be so, but I wanted to find out for myself to really know something. And through reincarnation, we can explore all the various ideas and all the various concepts that pull at us. Maybe in one lifetime you get a thought that, oh, I wonder about such and such. I wonder about how the universe was made, or I wonder, you know, what what it's like to really just be able to write such beautiful music. But you don't have time, or you're not able in that lifetime to pursue that thought or idea. And then what happens is it doesn't really matter, because there's really plenty of time. At some lifetime in the future, you will find yourself having the opportunity to pursue that farther, until you take it to the farthest degree of experience and you are satisfied and can move on.
I have a lot of people ask me this question from time to time. Do you think that we choose our next incarnation, or are there some rules concerning the next round?
Yes, but it's not so much we and our egos that choose, but more the deepest part of our being. Our souls make these choices. That part of us that is, quote that you quoted from my book about how when we leave our physical bodies, that our spirit expands, which is much greater than our bodies, much greater, in fact, than the personality that we're using as a sort of a framework for us to express through in this lifetime. And that part of us that is the deepest part of our nature, that is that actually our souls, our nature is wisdom, our nature is joy, our nature is truth. And from that state that is not touched by the cycles of birth and death, from that place we make these sort of choices. But our egos might take exception to some of those choices when we get into our physical bodies, and we experience these things. But we take it on as a soul challenge, whatever challenges come into our lifetimes or show up in our lifetimes.
Yeah, I know that the challenges of being in a physical body, I mean, we experience pain and we experience limitations and we wear out, we have fatigue, we have to sleep, and our conscious states are constantly altering because our brains are not made to stay on the same track all the time. We have to have some kind of variety. We have to have music and we have to sleep and we have to dream and all these kinds of things. So the way that we experience this world, this three-dimensional world, a lot of people say that this is not reality. But if this is the workshop that we keep coming back to, then it's got to be awfully important, doesn't it?
Yes. Well, it's true that in this physical plane, things are so much more black and white than in the astral world, which is the world of energy. The way the universe is constructed is that behind this physical world, there is a blueprint of an energy world. And behind that energy world is a blueprint in the ideational sphere, and that's called the causal plane. And so it's just like somebody who's an architect wanting to build a building. First, he visualizes what it is that he wants to build and thinks of all the qualities that are needed and certain specifics, and that comes about in the ideational plane. And then he draws up a blueprint for it, and that's what happens in the end. He puts out energy in a physical way to drop that blueprint, and so the astral world is that energy world. And then the last thing that he does is he actually constructs the building, which is on the physical plane. And so it's very hard to make spiritual progress when you're in the astral world, especially if you're on a high astral plane, because it's so pleasant, it's so beautiful, the lights and the sound and the music and the joy that you experience. It makes it very difficult for you to think about trying to move forward spiritually. But we get our lessons so much in black and white, as I said, here on the physical plane, that it's much easier for us to make that sort of progress.
Yeah, I can relate to that. I mean, look at the beings who we consider offhand to be very, very spiritually advanced, like, let's say, Jesus or Moses or Noah or Enoch or Adam, for that matter. Where did they come for their mortal life? Why did they have to come here for mortal life? And that's a great question, because they're passing through a mortal life, at least in our generation, some kind of history that we can track and we can relate to or read about. That really gives us an example, and I don't know about you, but I consider myself a much younger being than those who I just mentioned, And I consider, maybe I emulate them, and maybe I want to model my life after one or two of them, or try to reach that level of spirituality. If they're doing it in a mortal life here on this earth, I'm going to try it too.
Yes, yes, I agree completely. I feel that these great ones came not to show how great they are, but how great we can be potentially. And that they give an example that we can follow, not because they were born perfect and therefore they didn't have to struggle or didn't have to, you know, try to work their way to achieve what they had achieved, but more that they had gone through that and that then therefore what their example is something that can be truly meaningful to us and truly instructive.
Yeah. Well, here's another question that my listeners often ask me. There are about 7 billion people on the earth right now, more than ever before at one time. Where do all the spirits come from that are here now? I mean, they can't be incarnations of just earth beings. They must come from other worlds as well.
Yes, yes, absolutely, and that is the answer. You know, I follow the teachings. Actually, my book, Soul Journey from Lincoln to Lindbergh, is based on a statement by a great master of yoga and world teacher. His name is Paramahansa Yogananda. Many people know him as the author of the spiritual classic, Autobiography of a Yogi, and his picture actually was on the Sgt. Pepper album. He influenced the Beatles, Elvis Presley, and actually millions throughout the world. But he was a great master of yoga, and he said that that life in the universe is not limited to Earth. He said that the universe is actually teeming with life, that there are many other planets that we can be born onto to learn also essential lessons of life. And so we're not just limited to those who have been on this planet before, but many others coming in from other planets as well.
So then it's possible that they, as they're incarnated on this world, have life experience that somehow they've been able to remember or recall to a certain extent, like, say, Tesla or Einstein, and now they are recalling that they have done in more advanced civilizations on other worlds and trying to do those same things here.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yeah, so we're trying to take them a little farther, perhaps, than they had done before. What happens is that whenever we learn anything on a deep level, say such as a spiritual lesson, this is something that you carry with you forward through all of your incarnations. If you really learn an important lesson, it's always yours, and you can then have it as it's the treasure that we bring with us from lifetime to lifetime. There was a rich man who sought out a psychic to try to find out who he would be in his next life so he could will his money to that person. And they say you can't take it with you, and he wasn't really able to take it with him that way. But this is something that you can take with you. Any deep understanding, any deep knowledge, any deep wisdom is something that will be your treasure that you will always have with you. And also, like you were saying, sometimes we become really fascinated by one thing or another, whether it be science, you're talking about Tesla and Einstein, music or sports or athletics or any sort of endeavor of that type. We may pursue it for quite a number of lifetimes until we feel like we've really gotten what we need to get out of that. And so it could very well be with someone like Einstein, how that thought about you know, E = mc² just popping into his mind, how you know, the very idea of it, how he was able to tune into that. Obviously, his mind was already open to those sort of thoughts, and so it wasn't that far of a stretch for him to make that particular leap.
Well, I mean, we talk about the really good things like science, like Tesla or Einstein or even Da Vinci, but what about, and this is where I was getting at with the rules of reincarnation, what about propensities for war? We have beings who may have been a warlord in a past life, like Khan or Hitler or somebody like that. Is there a rule that says, okay, you can be reincarnated and go be a warlord again, and this time you won't make the same mistakes that Rommel made in the desert? Or do they come back as, because of some rule, as one of the victims that they took advantage of in their previous life so they can learn the other side?
I think it's a little bit of both. You know, their desire to learn about strategies and tactics in war We'll carry them forward to have other opportunities. But in between those opportunities, which are really few and far between, you know, of the many who participated, say, in World War II, only a small number were kind of in charge of everything that was going on and making decisions and learning from those decisions. But in between those lifetimes where they're able to pursue that idea, you know, the law of karma is such that they would have to also suffer from the decisions that they had made. But Yogananda said something interesting. He said that Hitler in a past life, for instance, you were talking about warlords being reborn. He said that Adolf Hitler in his past life was Alexander the Great. And they both use this blitzkrieg method of attack, this sort of really intense attack method, and they both had a similar goal to rule the world. He also said that Stalin had been Genghis Khan, and you see that same uncaring nature as to the well-being of other people in both men. So I'd say that both of those things are true that you were saying.
Those are very, very powerful analogies. Now, that beep usually means we have a caller on the line. Caller, can you give us your first name and where you're calling from?
Hi, are you asking me?
Yes.
Yeah, this is Anne, and I'm calling from Lake County.
Hello, you
asked me to call you.
How are you, sweetheart?
I'm good. How are you?
Doing wonderful. How are you?
You sound good. I mean, it's been really busy. I tried for an hour to get you.
Well, I know, but we've been really busy tonight.
Have you? Good. Well, that's great.
A lot of bandwidth going tonight.
Yeah, I can't hear you very well.
Well, that's okay.
Yeah.
Have you been listening?
Pardon?
Have you been listening to the program?
I can't. I have this web TV. It's not like a computer, and it won't let me listen.
Oh, I understand.
Yeah.
Well,
when my daughter is here, she has a computer, and I can get her to get on, but she isn't here, so...
I'll have
to do it another time. Anyway, I just wanted to tell you, I sent you a little tape. I hope you can hear it. You asked for a minute tape, remember?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I sent it to your home.
All right, I sure appreciate it.
And you'll see it, and I put a little picture of me in it so you know what I look like.
Wonderful.
Well, I know what you look like.
Well, I don't know where we would be without guests, without listeners like you. We really appreciate you.
Well, you're very sweet. Thank you. And I won't keep you long. I just wanted to say that. And what does it cost to go on the thing to the North Pole?
Well, there's no cost. We're raising the money through donations and fundraisers because we don't want a boat full of rich tourists. What we're trying to do is put together an expedition with the right people with the right consciousness, and the only way
to
cover all the costs.
You know, like I told you before, I am 84, so I don't know whether you really want to take someone that age with you.
Well, I think you're young enough to go.
Well, we'll see. Yeah, I'm going to Shasta to hear David Miller. Do you know him?
I don't. But I'll be at Shasta at the same time he will be.
Will you?
Yeah, I'll be at the same event.
Oh, really? Well, I'll see you there then. That's on July 7th and 8th.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, good. Okay. Well, I'll talk to you then.
All right.
All right. Thank you. Bye
bye. Bye. I have Anne's one of my most loyal listeners out there, so I try to make sure that she's at home when she calls in. Richard, I had another question relative, you know, because you brought up the law of karma or this karmic law that basically one way to think about it, if you're not into such things, is what goes around comes around. What you do in this life will set up energy vibrations that not only affect the beings around you, but it also comes around behind you if you do bad things to slap you in the head, and if you do great things to lift you up.
Yes.
So how is it that your study subjects, Lindbergh and Lincoln, how did they become aware of this law of karma? How did they work it for themselves in their lives?
Well, you know, I'm not sure if they were that aware of it. I know that they Yogananda had said that the basis of my book, Soul Journey from Lincoln to Lindbergh, is something that Yogananda had said. He said that Abraham Lincoln in a past life had been an advanced Himalayan yogi and that he was reborn as Charles Lindbergh. So I investigated their lives and studied their histories and found nearly 500 very fascinating similarities and connections between Lincoln and Lindbergh, more than 200 between Abraham Lincoln and the ancient spiritual science of yoga, and more than 100 between Lindbergh and yoga. So that's my book that we're discussing here. So you're asking about awareness of karma in the lives of Lincoln and Lindbergh. I don't know how much they were aware of it, but they certainly had brought forward from the Himalayan lifetime an understanding of the golden rule of doing as you would be done by, generally speaking. Sometimes I saw when I was studying both their lives, situations that brought out the karmic law. Most people think that karma means a punishment, but the word karma actually means action. And it's a lot like you describe. It's an impersonal teaching tool of the universe, so that it's a corollary to Newton's third law of motion. For every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. So like you say, whatever you put out comes back to you, and over time it teaches you. And it's impersonal in the same way that certain other laws of the universe are impersonal, so that if you, say, put your hand on a burning stove, if you keep your hand there, you'll destroy your hand. And that's why you feel that burning sensation, so you'll remove your hand and you won't lose your hand. It's not there to punish you, it's there to teach. And it's the same thing with the law of karma. But I saw interesting karmic connections between the two men. On a negative sense of things, Abraham Lincoln, his father was dying and wrote to him and asked him to visit him. But Lincoln didn't have a very good connection with his dad, so he didn't go. Instead, he wrote a letter in which he said, if I were to come now, I don't think that things would work out very well between us. But he just encouraged him to put himself and his fate in the hands of God, basically. And for Charles Lindbergh, when his father was dying, he wanted very much to go see his dad, but he wasn't able to go because of the circumstances of his life. So instead, he had to write a letter when he would have preferred to have been able to go. So there you see, again, how the karmic law comes around that way. And on a positive level, Abraham Lincoln, in his life, when he was president, he often sort of stretched things for his generals and gave them second chances when they didn't do very well. He sometimes almost bent over backwards to try to allow them one more opportunity to make good. And in the life of Charles Lindbergh, he wanted to participate in World War II. He wanted to fight for America in World War II, but he had had a falling out with FDR. And so FDR told everyone not to allow him to participate. But there were certain generals in the U.S. Army in World War II, MacArthur and Kenney, who wanted to give Lindbergh a second chance, wanted him to be able to, you know, make good. And so they allowed him to participate in the war, so he was able to participate in 50 missions in the Pacific.
Wow. You know, that reminds me of a story I heard of Abraham Lincoln. He was on the porch of his house, and one of his intelligence officers came to him and told him of some heinous acts that one of his colonels was performing, which meant that Lincoln was going to have to take action and take him out of service. And he relayed this to his intelligence officer by saying, you know, one day I was out on this porch and I saw a squirrel in my front yard, and it ran up a big oak tree and ran down inside the tree, and I realized the tree was hollow. He said, you know what I wish? And the intelligence officer said, what, Mr. President? He said, I wish I'd never seen that squirrel. Because he knew he had to cut that tree down.
Right.
Or it was
right.
Going to fall on the house.
So he had the same reaction there. He didn't want to have to be the one to bring out the axe for this colonel.
And I think a lot of us see Lincoln as that, sort of the reluctant, you know, juggernaut, that here he was handed a nation, you know, ripping apart at the seams, two tremendously powerful political factions pulling the nation in two. We almost had another South America to deal with.
Yes.
And he had a very tough task and made decisions that were globally unpopular.
Yes.
In trying to pull a nation back together, and literally was the bloodiest war this nation's ever been in.
Yes, about 600,000 casualties in the Civil War.
Unbelievable. A brother against brother. And here was a man that had to leave that. And here he was, this, you know, incarnated, peaceful being trying
yes.
to do what is right.
Yes, one of the, it's fascinating because one of the central teachings of yoga is called ahimsa, which means nonviolence. In fact, Mahatma Gandhi was a major modern proponent of this teaching of nonviolence. And any Himalayan yogi worth his salt would have understood this teaching and worked really hard to master it and practice it. And Abraham Lincoln, if you look at his life, even as a young man, when he saw other children hurting animals, he wrote a little tract against violence toward animals. He never wore gloves because he didn't want to wear the skins of dead animals that had been killed. He and Mary Todd didn't spank their children at a time when that was considered just what everybody should do. And,
sure, spare the rod, spoil the child kind of age.
Yes, exactly. And they were out of sync with that because they both believed that wasn't the way to go, and they were very modern that way. But they had this understanding, especially Lincoln. He had this innate nonviolence. He could stand up for himself, and he could be strong when necessary. And if he had to, he would defend himself and others. But by nature, he never initiated violence against anyone, and it was foreign to his very nature. And so to be the man, and like you say, to have to be the proponent of the Northern involvement in this war, to promote it, it was like a crucifixion for his spirit. And it's funny because you see Charles Lindbergh, when World War II was starting to kind of build up, at the time when it was a war in Europe, and there was a chance, you know, that America might become involved, he, after a very short period of time, just started to get out there making speeches, trying to discourage people, fellow Americans, from the idea of America being involved in that war. He saw that it could be a great bloody cataclysm, and his whole purpose, he said, in doing that was so that fewer Americans might die in the conflict. Now, when you look at Abraham Lincoln during the Civil War, he had this, it was a very painful experience for him on a personal level, having to be commander-in-chief during that conflict. Like you said, one of the bloodiest wars in history. And he died within a week of the signing of Robert E. Lee at Appomattox. The war itself was still going on. There were still soldiers dying in the battlefield, and when he was killed by John Wilkes Booth. And so he died, even on the last day of his life, he spoke longingly of bringing the country together, of healing everyone, as he said in the second inaugural, of binding the nation's wounds, of caring for the widow and the orphan. This was something that was very near and dear to his heart, but that opportunity to do that, his second term of office, was stolen away from him. And then as Lindbergh, he saw himself as an opportunity. He was able to influence many thousands of people because he was so well known and people looked up to him, and he just felt that it was his personal duty to try to convince Americans not to become engaged again in another conflict like that. So he put all of his energy into that, and people wondered why he did that, but you have an explanation right there in reincarnation.
Well, you brought up an interesting point about this innateness. You say in your book that we bring our self-image forward with us.
Yes.
When we finally become self-aware, say, I don't know, the age of 17 or 22, some people become self-aware at 12, these deep traits supersede the teachings of our parents, and they come out in our desires and our dreams. If our last incarnation was not famous like Lincoln or Lindbergh, how can we go back and recall what we need to know for this life? So that we don't have to start again at ground zero each time.
Well, for anyone who wants to know more about their past lives, the best way to do so is by learning to meditate. In meditation, you realize that you are an eternal spirit. untouched by the cycles of birth and death. Over time, as you meditate, you'll start to remember past life connections in such a way that is beneficial for you, that is helpful for you, helpful to your spiritual growth, helpful for you to be able to heal something that came from the past. There are quite a number of people nowadays who are realizing that the things that are happening right now in their lives have a connection to something that had happened, something that they had done or experienced in a past life. And they are working to work out that connection. And I actually encourage people and try to help them to do that. That's one of the things that I do. And the way that I look at it is this. It's as if you're going along a forest path and you get hooked by this big thorn. And this thorn is at the end of a long creeper and it's hooked into your flesh, but you don't realize it until you walk far enough along the path where the vine becomes taut and suddenly it's pulling at you. Then what you need to do is you need to walk back in the direction where you had originally gotten that thorn, just far enough to unhook it and free yourself of it so you don't injure yourself even worse. And then you can move forward. We don't want to live in our past lives, but sometimes it's helpful to be able to tune into them enough to release something that has a hold on us for us to move forward. And similarly, if there's a positive thing, sometimes it can be helpful to tune into that to inspire us to also move forward.
So it's kind of like clearing. You're going back and you're clearing some kind of block or an iron ball that's hanging around your ankle,
yes,
so that you could move forward in this life.
Yes. Many people will try to process what happened to them in their childhood because they realize that that helped to form who they are now. But if we were to realize that we had lived in all these other lifetimes, it's not just the childhood, which is a shorter period of time, but an actual whole lifetime, and not just one, but many of them, we see how important sometimes it can be to have that understanding. But the way the spiritual law works is that as we start to grow spiritually, these things become more apparent to us. And as, like I said, in meditation is helpful because if you really think that you are this physical body, if you really think that you are just this one personality that you've chosen to assume, like a jacket you put on when on a windy day, if that's who and what you are, then it's really hard for you to tune into the fact that you had also put on another body and personality in this time and another one here and another one there. And that actually the only way to realize that is to realize that none of those were the definition of who and what you are, but that you are the spirit that went through those experiences and are now going through these experiences in the present time.
Yeah, but it's like you say, this, even though we're putting on a jacket, even though we're putting on this body onto our spirit, it doesn't mean that it's not real because, you know, you said that every desire that comes into your heart must eventually be fulfilled or transcended. Now, that means that you don't just discover this is all an illusion and you're going to bliss out and you're just going to meditate and tune this world out and you're going
right.
to become a recluse. You've got to fulfill those dreams and desires.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it's true. This Yogananda used to say that this world is God's dream, you know, and we look at the physical matter through an electron microscope and we see that there's much more space there than there is matter. These tiny specks of matter just spinning around and like planets around a sun, and that there's enough similar amount of space between each bit of matter as there is between the stars and the heavens. And so it's all this big illusion that's true, and even the scientists will tell you that it's all really just energy. But there are certain laws in the physical creation, and if you go against those laws, then you're going to suffer for it. And as Yogananda said, this world is God's dream. But even in a dream, it's better to dream wisely. And so it's important for us to understand these laws and to work with them so that we can have the best dream experience of all. Eventually, we'll realize that it was all just one big dream. But when we're in the middle of it, even in the middle of a dream, if you're having a nightmare, it's very real to you. And the suffering is very real. And we need to be able to work with things as they are if we want to move forward.
Oh, that's an amazing statement. It would make a great T-shirt, Dream Wisely.
Yes. I like one of those.
You state that desire is a powerful thing, and I've heard it said that it is the one thing that denotes a sentient being, that when we have desire, we are conscious beings. How does this desire affect reincarnation? If you've really got a strong desire and something happens in your life, you're caught in an explosion or a fire, or you drown or you die before your time and you don't get this desire fulfilled, you're destined to come back and do that again.
Mm-hmm. Yes, very much so. And if you worked really hard, say, you know, we see this in life. Sometimes somebody will live a lifetime where they work very hard toward achieving something, and suddenly they're taken out of that lifetime right before they're able to achieve it. Well, in their next life, they'll have a leg up. They'll be born into a family that will make it easier for them to do so. Say if they want to succeed in business and they were on the verge of doing so, but they died for some reason, something happened, made it impossible to do. In their next lifetime, they might be born, you know, as an offspring of Donald Trump, you know, or in that sort of a family. So whatever it is that we desire, as you mentioned, I wrote this in my book, it has to be eventually fulfilled or transcended. So I also mentioned in my book, we might want to be careful about what we wish for, because eventually everything that we want will come to us, even if the timing is inconvenient or if we feel we don't want it anymore.
Well, I was listening to one of the lecturers that uses the book, Rhonda Byrne's book, The Secret, as their basis for their business. Mm-hmm. And he said, you know, it's good to have this desire. It's good to have a dream, but you also have to put action behind it. You've got to get off the front porch and go out and try stuff to achieve your dream, because this sets up the real energy and tension in the universe and allows things to resonate with you.
Yes, that's true. We have to put energy in motion to attract whatever it is that we want to achieve in the universe. That's true. But it's by putting out energy that our understanding develops. Even if we start putting out energy when we don't really understand clearly what it is that we want, by doing so, we'll clarify our understanding, clarify our desire, so that we begin to realize what it is that we really and truly want. I like the example of Francis of Assisi. He was praying before the cross, and he heard the words, rebuild my church. And he looked around him, and he was in an old ruined church, and he thought, well, I need to rebuild this church. So he started to, you know, get bricks and mortar and everything that he needed to actually physically rebuild the church that he had been praying in. And then over time, by doing that, other people started to follow him, and he started to grow in his spiritual mastery and his ability to lead people spiritually. And eventually, near the end of his life, he realized that what was being asked of him was more to rebuild the whole church of Catholicism or Christianity at that time, helping people to tune into their spirituality in a much deeper way.
Well, I'm kind of glad you brought that up, because I want to ask you a question. Is it true that the idea of multiple mortal lives was always in the scriptures, but it was removed by early Christian leaders?
You know, Yogananda said, if you look at the New Testament, it's fascinating to note that of four disciples of Christ, none of them mentioned the 18 missing years, or I think when he was between the ages of 12 and 30. All that one said is that he grew in wisdom or something like that, something very general.
He waxed
strong. Now, if you were a biographer, not to mention the disciple of a great master, do you think that you would just skip most of that lifetime? You know, there must have been wonderful things that happened during that time period, and they're not in any of those four Gospels. You got four different writings of it, and all four of them have nothing, basically. And here you see, you know, just very clear evidence that someone had taken those words out of there, but didn't feel like they were able to just sort of substitute anything else except one very general statement in one of those Gospels. And Yogananda actually said that during that time period that Christ had actually traveled to India and had gone to return the visit of the Magi when they came from the East, and to connect with them, and to study there, and to teach there, and to grow there as he was just as he was growing in Palestine, and then he returned to Palestine and had his mission there.
Oh yeah, I have a friend, Mikhail Ledwith, who just produced a movie early this year, maybe it was late last year, called How Jesus Became a Christ, and he details the travels of Jesus. He actually has evidence and writings of Jesus and his brother as they went through these different monasteries, the things that they learned and the things that they taught and the kind of trouble they got into for teaching those things to the wrong class of people. You know, India is divided up into classes.
Yes,
so he did not make friends with the government. But then when he went back to Bethlehem, back to Jerusalem, to find John the Baptist, he took all these teachings with him.
Yes, and that's why he was able to really revolutionize the understanding of the Jews that were his disciples, able to help them to see the deeper teachings that that were there. You know, the scripture, the true scripture, has is able to teach us on many different levels, and you see that too in the Old Testament. If you can really understand it on a deep level, you can understand it. It can take you very far, but sometimes we can get stuck at a certain level, and often when you've got sort of straitjacketed teachings that are, you know, part of a liturgy or a dogma, you know, it's hard to be able to go beyond them. But then you have a great master like Christ coming in. It's just like a breath of fresh air. It's just like fresh water coming in and washing out everything that is sort of gathered and accumulated over time.
Right, right. Yeah, sort of clearing the money changers out of the dogma of religion.
Yes.
You know, there are examples in the scriptures of men who have gotten started on the wrong track, and then other beings have to step in against their will and turn them to a different path. It's sort of like the story of Saul, who was visited by Jesus after his resurrection. Jesus turned Saul into Paul and changed his life's work in 3 days.
Yes.
Now, I'm not saying we're all like Saul, that, you know, some angel or some ascended master is going to step into our life and say, Brooks or Richard, you know, you're on the wrong path. Please go do this. But do you think it's possible that there are messengers that we might have agreed with before we came back to this life that might bring knowledge of our past or of technology to help us speed along our path toward our dream?
Yes, I believe that's possible. It depends on our own personal dharma, as they say in India, our own personal duty in this lifetime. But, you know, there's another teaching in India that we go through these cycles of time. And according to that, there are four different ages, and we might start off at the very lowest age, which is the age of matter consciousness, Kali Yuga, and come up into the age of energy, which is Dwapara Yuga, and then up through that into Treta Yuga, the age of magnetism, and then up into the highest age, which is the age of spirit, which is Satya Yuga. And it's also possible that in a past life, we had either on this planet, I mean, you look at how they were able to build the pyramids and do things like that that we're not able to duplicate yet, and understand that there were higher ages in which we had this sort of knowledge. It's possible that somebody might be able to tune in again to that knowledge, to bless the world with that knowledge, and help us to move forward.
Well, but, you know, we talk about people like Tesla and Einstein. Tesla, you know, openly said in his lifetime that the technology that he brought to the world came to him in a dream state.
Yes.
You know, it was either brought to him or he recalled it. But it seems I distinctly remember that there were masters or people who appeared to be famous masters in our lifetime or in past lifetime or past history that claimed that there were messengers or guides or disembodied spirits or forces that came to them and gave them information.
Mm-hmm.
Mathematicians, astronomers.
You know, Abraham Lincoln wondered about this, and he actually studied the Old Testament trying to find evidence of angels coming to bring knowledge to man. In the teachings of yoga, which is my basis of study, Patanjali said that we gain this sort of knowledge. He said it's the knowledge of higher spheres, and that we get it through the practice of introspection. If we're really trying to understand the truth of our natures, eventually this knowledge from higher spheres will come to us, whether it's through the agency or a particular being. It could be during a waking state, we could have a vision. It could be in deep meditation. You could be given a very deep and powerful inspiration. But for many of us, we close off our minds to these higher spiritual things during our daily lives because we're so mind-bound, and especially here in America. You know, I often teach in a church that's right across the street from Stanford University. You know, we're very intellectual. We think so much. We're so focused on the conscious mind that we may not tune into the other parts of our mind, the subconscious or the superconscious. But when we, during the daytime, so for most of us during the daytime, we have our minds shut off to these deeper levels of understanding. But during the night, when it's all quiet and we go into a sleep state, we're already in a subconscious state. We might be visited during that state by messengers from higher spheres, giving us information, giving us inspiration. If we're looking for anything in particular, they will give us inspiration related to what it is that we're seeking for.
Well, I think that's immensely powerful. And I think as I go forward in my own life, I'm sort of leaving the religious dogma behind, the strict, you know, we only get one shot at mortality, and if you don't do it right, well, you're just going to hell. I'm sort of leaving that behind. I'm realizing that, like my listeners who call in and write in all the time, there is a lot more to this universe than we can see in this three-dimensional world.
Yes, you know, Abraham Lincoln actually rejected that same teaching that you had just mentioned. When he was a young man, he actually wrote a tract sort of answering point by point many of the dogmas that he was just, that were repeated to him almost like parrot-like during that he experienced in his young life. And a friend of his took this thing that he wrote and threw it into a fireplace. He said, "I want to save your reputation." But, you know, Lindbergh was the same way, too. He met people who spoke the way that you, in the way that you had mentioned, and he just didn't feel attracted to it. He thought that he said that spirituality was, that religion should be spiritual food for the soul, and not just these sort of really kind of stuck-in-the-mud teachings that he didn't feel in attunement with. And so it's interesting that you mentioned that.
Well, I think it's interesting that a man like Lindbergh, who would climb into a radial engine aircraft full of so much gasoline there wasn't room for anything else, and fly across the Atlantic, he must have had great spiritual communion while he was fighting off fatigue and disorientation, trying to make that trek. I would be very interested if he ever left a diary, a really detailed spiritual diary of that trip.
He actually did write about it in his Pulitzer Prize-winning book, The Spirit of St. Louis, and also he wrote about it. He had these deep spiritual and metaphysical experiences during that flight that most people don't know about, and he mentioned them. They were so important to him and something that he mulled on during his lifetime, obviously, because in his final autobiography, his Autobiography of Values, he writes about them three times. When he was halfway across the Atlantic, he was feeling like he just had to fall asleep. The night before, he'd had almost no sleep at all. Then the flight itself lasted for 33 and a half hours.
So
you can imagine how sleepy he was. And his conscious and subconscious minds were at battling. The subconscious saying he's got to sleep, and his conscious mind saying, no, if you fall asleep, you'll plunge into the ocean and drown. And then he said a third part of his mind spoke to him. This is his superconscious, and said, no, you're going to rest, but you're not going to fall asleep. And so his body was like flying the airplane on autopilot beyond his conscious control. And he went into this superconscious state where he could see all around the cockpit at once. He could see out the back of his head, something that yogis experience sometimes in deep meditation called spherical vision. And while he was experiencing this, you were talking about messengers coming. The cockpit of his airplane was filled with these spiritual beings, a number of them, and they came forward one by one to speak to him mind to mind and spirit to spirit. And he said he could never remember exactly what they said, But it was obviously something very powerful experience for him. And he said, he wrote in the Spirit of St. Louis, they seemed so familiar to me, I wonder if I had known them in a past life. And
wow.
So you can imagine if he had been a Himalayan yogi in a past life, how these might have been friends of his who were also advanced yogis coming to support him in this crucial moment of his life, making this flight. And
absolutely.
Then after they disappeared, his spirit separated from his physical body. He experienced astral projection, and he shot forward through the nose of his aircraft. And as he said in his book, he mixed with the wash of his propeller, and then he was flying next to the Spirit of St. Louis in his astral body. At that point, Lucky Lindy was flying two planes at once, the Spirit of St. Louis and the astral plane.
Oh, that's amazing. Absolutely amazing.
Yes.
Richard, I have so many more questions for you, and perhaps we can have you back on the program and get deeper into them.
I would love that.
But you suggested that we bring on your friend Jeffrey Keane.
Yes.
And we're into our final hour, so as we break now for commercial, we'll bring him on, and maybe you can help us introduce him, and then we'll let you go and continue with him.
Can I mention real quick, if they're interested in my book, they can find it at LincolnReincarnation.com.
LincolnReincarnation.com. X Squared Radio. We'll be back. And welcome back, Earth Explorers. Before we begin this hour, I want to make sure that you order your copy of the Inner Earth Expedition video, Part 1. It came off the presses last week, and we will ship it to you this week if you order right away. I can tell you this, there is breakthrough archaeology in this video, never before seen. If you like documentaries, if you like Discovery Channel, History Channel, digging deep and finding the truth and all that stuff, you are really going to enjoy this video. There's music in it. There's never before film stuff in it. If you ever needed something you could show your friends as to what hollow earth theory was or how ancient cultures may have known much more than they apparently shared with us, you need to order this video. Just go to x2-radio.com and click on the DVD that's on the front page there, and it'll take you directly to the online store where you can buy it. Believe me, $20 was never so well spent. It'll all go toward funding the North Pole expedition next year. This hour, Jeffrey Keane was born in Danbury, Connecticut in 1947 and grew up in the town of Westport, Connecticut. An accomplished Civil War researcher and speaker, he has lectured on Civil War topics to groups ranging from elementary students to peer experts. His story was featured on the Arts and Entertainment Network's documentary Beyond Death, an independent documentary titled In Another Life, and on the Sci-Fi Channel program Proof Positive. Someone Else's Yesterday was a finalist in the 2004 Visionary Awards held at the International New Age Trade Show in Denver, Colorado in June of 2004, not so long ago. Please welcome the author of Someone Else's Yesterday, Jeffrey Keane. How are you tonight, Jeffrey?
Pretty good, Dr. Agnew. And Logan, Richard.
Well, we had to let Richard go so that we could take phone calls.
Oh.
If we kept Richard, we wouldn't be able to let our listeners participate, so we're going to let them participate this hour. I read Jeffrey Keane's compelling reincarnation case history, and I learned how one of America's greatest battlefield heroes, you might not know the name, but he definitely was great. His name was Confederate General John B. Gordon, has returned to life as a warrior for peace. Maybe you can tell us, Jeffrey, how that can be.
As you discussed in the earlier part of your program and everything about the Civil War, it was one of the most deadly wars that were ever fought. You know, over 630,000 men died, and that was right during the war and after. You can imagine all the people that passed on because of the wounds and so on. kind of what happened in that lifetime has kind of affected me in this lifetime. Now I just retired in 2003. I was an assistant chief on the fire department in Westport, Connecticut, and you can't get more closer to a combat unit as a fire department in civilian life. And you take the fact back then was a lot of taking of lives, and this time around, you know, being in fire rescue, it's the other end of the spectrum, saving lives. So. And also with my story, I didn't realize I was writing a book. It just all kind of fell in place and what things were pointing at. And long after I was convinced of reincarnation, things kept happening to reinforce it more and more, and I had more and more material. And the only thing I could figure out, I was supposed to write it down for other people to see and maybe get their minds working and see what we're doing here on this planet.
Well, how did those pieces fall into place for you, Jeffrey? I mean, you know, you get a piece here and a piece there, and somebody says, hey, you have a striking resemblance to General Gordon. How did you pursue that thread?
Well, this is strange. A lot of people that hear my story, they think that I probably was big into the Civil War, a reenactor, and it couldn't be the farthest thing from the truth. Before I had a strange experience on Antietam battlefield, I had never read a book on the Civil War, I'm sorry to say. But I was traveling with my wife, and I'd seen a few of the Ken Burns series and was down in the area of Sharpsburg, Maryland, where the Battle of Antietam was fought, and that was the bloodiest single day in the history of the United States. It was 23,000 killed, wounded, and missing in an 11-hour battle. So I felt compelled to go over to this battlefield and see it for myself, and went to a section there called the cornfield, walked around with my wife, and she was looking at some of the monuments with me, and she got tired of doing that and sat in the car, and that was the end of her historical career. And the next portion of the battlefield I went to was known as the Sunken Road, and I left my wife in the parking lot and walked over to the Sunken Road and played a little tape that was in a stone wall there that told some of the things that transpired in that portion of the field. And then I walked down some stone stairs into the road itself and made a left-hand turn and walked about 50 yards, and I was hit with the only way I can describe it is like an anxiety reaction. I was angry. I was sad. There was all these different emotions. I started crying. I couldn't breathe. I was having difficulty breathing. I thought maybe I was having a heart attack or something, but I didn't have any of the pain. And I still can't tell you to this day whether I stood there, you know, a minute to 5 minutes, 10 minutes, half hour, or what. But after I literally crawled up out of the road, because there was an embankment there, I felt like I had run a marathon. And I didn't say anything to my wife because, you know, what could I tell her? I didn't know what happened myself, and I didn't want to worry her. So I drove to another portion of the battlefield there, Burnside's Bridge, and walked around and gathered myself together. And then when we were leaving the area, my wife wanted to buy some Lake Anna wine, local wine that they have there, and her name's Anna. So we got some of that, and I was looking around. I saw a magazine that said Civil War Quarterly Antietam Edition, and picked it up and threw it on the counter. I told my wife, I said, I want this. And then there was a little bullet mini ball from supposed to be battlefield found in that area, and I told her I wanted that too and brought them home. And we have to flash forward a year and a half. A friend of ours was born on Halloween, and his wife rented a room at one of the restaurants in Monroe, Connecticut, and did the place up all nice, and had a woman there that she wanted to dress up in a gypsy costume and tell fortunes and all that, but this woman was very serious about what she did and didn't, you know, want to wear the costume. And I had never seen a psychic or anybody like that before, and I was going through a line to have a cartoon done. There was a guy doing caricatures, and my wife and I went through the line, but I'm watching the palm reader all the time. And I'm saying to myself, she's pretty good. She's not repeating herself, and she sounds sincere and all that, so maybe I'll try it. So after dinner, went through the line and sat down, and she started treating me differently than all the other people I watched her with. She dropped my hands a few times and started asking me some questions and all that, and she said, you understand about things happening, and you're very intelligent and all, and of course I'm nodding yes. I'm not going to argue with somebody telling me I'm intelligent, but she said, you know about doors and things opening and closing and so on, and she said, do you believe in past lives? And I said, well, yeah. She says, well, there's a question mark there. And I said, well, I don't know. I can't go over and pick up a toy I picked with, played with 300 years ago or so. But I have the feeling, you know, God doesn't even waste a drop of water, you know. And I've always felt that when we go through life, you know, you finally get up to an age where things are starting to make sense and all the knowledge you've gathered and all of a sudden, you know, the lights go out and the worms get you and that's it. I think there's more to it than that.
Uh-huh.
And she said, and I told her I've had some strange things happen to me through my life, and she said, like what? And I told her what happened at Sunken Road. And she said, that's because you died there. She said, but you were hovering over your body, and you're very angry, and you yelled no. And for some reason, I said to her, not yet. She says, yes, like not yet. And, well, there was a bunch of people in line, so I had to go. And then I got back in line again. I wanted to ask her another question. Why at that time I thought it was important, I don't know. But I got to her again. She said, I've taken you as far as I can go. I said, let me ask you something. Are you sure he was dead? She said, oh, honey, you had holes all through you. I said, oh, okay. So the next day I took my wife to work, and I go back home, and I'm sitting there, and I remember the Civil War magazine I had to have, and it was in with my phone books. I'd never put any other magazine in with my phone books. So now, anytime during that year and a half, somebody asked me where that magazine was, I knew exactly where it was. So now I realized I treated it differently than any magazine I ever had, and I took, maybe it's time to look at it, and I took it out and opened it up to the portion on the Sunken Road, and I skim down the page, and I catch a two-word quote, and the hair stands up on the back of my neck. It says, not yet, the same thing I said to the palm reader the night before.
Oh, my goodness.
So I read that quote was from a colonel, John Gordon. He was a colonel at the time of Antietam, and his men were getting antsy, and they wanted to fire. The Union troops were getting closer and closer, and Gordon wanted them to get right on top of him before he fired, you know, sort of like the Bunker Hill type thing. And he kept yelling, I'm not yet, wait for orders from the center. So now I'm wondering about what this is all about, and I look at the page next to the one I'm reading, and there's a picture of a general, John B. Gordon, and I say, he's a colonel in the story, he's a general in the picture. And the story said he'd been wounded 5 times that day, and I thought the last round that they talked about, probably the one that killed him, and I look at the caption under the picture, and it says, general. I said, he survived, and then I look at the face of the picture, and I tell people I know it very well. I shave it every morning. So,
wow.
That was what started the story. So when people ask me, you know, how did this all start, I tell them it started. My story starts in the middle of an old sunken road in a battlefield in Maryland.
So you felt a definite connection with this being, this human who had been in this battle, who had been a great leader, who had died in this area, or at least was heavily wounded in this area, and he connected with you. And the remarkable thing is when you put your profile, your facial profile, up against his profile, with the exception of the hat and the scraggly beard, you're him.
Oh, yeah, the proof positive people got a hold of me, and I told them I'd stand behind everything I wrote in the book, and they took me to task on it. I was with them for 6 days. They gave me a 3-hour lie detector test. I had a physical exam by a doctor who checked the 5 markings on my body that match up where Gordon was wounded during the Civil War. I've got 3 on my face, 2 on my right leg, and 1 on my left arm. And a polygraph I passed with a 99.6. I thought I got a 94.6, and I thought, you know, 50-50, you're half telling the truth and half being deceitful. And the director and the producer said, you didn't get a 94.6. You got a 99.6, and we're glad you didn't do any better. Also, my friend Walter Simkew has a book out, Return of Revolutionaries, and our books both came out at the same time, and he wanted to know if it was okay if he paid for a linguistics expert to check my writing, compare my writing against General Gordon's writing. Now, the portion that he gave the linguistics expert was something that I wrote long before my book, and it was something. It was a report on the fire department, and he noticed that there was a similarity between Gordon's writing and mine. And this lady from Berkeley checked the this small sample, and she said they matched in seven different areas, the use of words and the rhythm and different things. The photo comparison.
That's pretty intriguing.
Yeah.
Because the way you structure words, the way you speak, the way you put your thoughts together, it's not really something that you inherit genetically. That's something that's the driving spirit behind you. And if you are the reincarnated Gordon, then you would use similar phraseology, similar stress methods, because that's the way you think. That's the way you express yourself. So is that what you're saying, that those things are very similar?
Oh yeah, there's a lot of similarities. And you mentioned the photos before. The proof positive people had one of the top men facial recognition experts compare photos of Gordon and myself. And he said the upper face as a whole, the eyes and nose, the forehead, stuff like that, he said they're a pretty good match. Now
you're not genetically related. I mean, you're not an ancestor of him?
No. I can't find him anywhere in the background there, no.
That sure adds a lot of strength to the argument that we, as conscious beings, shape ourselves. We basically have very similar skeletons. And maybe very similar musculature, but actually the way that we smile, the way that we frown, that we think, that we eat, that we move, we exercise, we actually shape what we look like. And it would make sense that if you were the same being, that you would be generally the same shape, with maybe an exception of an inch or two in height.
Yeah, we're around the same height. I read that Gordon was 6 feet. I'm slightly over 6 feet. It seems we have the same color eyes, and it was strange that my eye color seems to change with what I wear. And most people would say my eyes are blue, but I remember I was going in the Air Force when I was 17, had to have a consent form signed, and my mother was filling it out, and she put down my eyes were gray. In something that I read from some of the things I read from the Civil War, people had mentioned Gordon's blue eyes, but I read something that was written by one of his daughters, and she said his eyes were gray. So it seems like people making the same mistakes through history here. Most of the photos, you see Gordon, and he's standing with his arms folded, which I've always tended to do, and rather stand than sit. And some of the, being a shift commander, sometimes you have to find out the story on different things and discipline people and all that. And I went to one of the stations that was out from headquarters because it was a problem. And I always like to get the whole story before making a decision on what should be done about it. And after I talked to the two guys, I turned around and left. And I said, well, we will ponder this one, gentlemen. And later on, one of the guys had brought it up to the chief. What's this? We will ponder this one, gentlemen. But then when this Gordon stuff, I said, that's like a Gordon-esque type thing that just, and this was way before any of this Gordon stuff happened. But
wow.
Probably the real shocker was that I told you Gordon was wounded five times at Antietam. He wrote a book, Reminiscence of the Civil War, and he tells about his wounding. He was shot first through the right calf. And then he said higher up on the same leg. And then he was shot in the left arm, he said, which mangled some tendons and all. And I had a blood clot removed there years ago and asked the doctor where the blood clot came from. He said, oh, they just happened. And he was hit in the left shoulder. But the last round entered just under his left eye. And you know the difference between an entry wound and an exit wound. And it blew the right side of his face completely off, broke his jaw, and, almost severed the jugular vein, which was the closest thing to maybe something that was going to kill him. He doesn't understand. In his writings, he didn't understand why he survived. I think what that psychic saw was like an out-of-body thing, and he actually, survived for many years after that. But that last round to the face was the worst one. And when I was 30 years old, and I remember the date, it was September 9th, 1977, because that was my birthday. The evening before, just before midnight, we had had a union meeting, and I went with some of the firemen and my brother down to a local VFW. We left a little after midnight, and I got such an horrendous pain in my right jaw and down into my neck and everything, and I've been a medic in the Air Force, and I knew it could be referred pain from a heart attack or something, but it was really nasty, and I told my brother to get me over to the hospital, and they took x-rays and EKGs and all kinds of picking and probing and couldn't find anything, and pain sub- subsided and finally went away. But, I tended to remember, seeing I was on my 30th birthday, I tended to remember, you know, a lot of people say, what did you do on your 30th birthday? I always spent it over the hospital. But now, this Gordon thing, the trip down to the Antietam battlefield, I was in my early 40s. Remembering back to the hospital visit and reading about Gordon, I said I was suffering pain that mimicked the worst wound that he had at Antietam. And then you don't have to be a mathematician to figure it out. Gordon was born in 1832. The Battle of Antietam was fought in 1862. So he was 30 years old when he was shot through the face. So here I was in 1977 in the hospital suffering pain from a wound that Gordon had received 115 years before and a decade before I ever first heard his name.
But you had an age memory exactly at 30 years of age. Were there other memories that you had that linked up with him before you even knew?
Well, when I went to the Sunken Road, you know, I hadn't done any studying on the Civil War. That magazine was the first thing that a book or magazine I ever bought on the Civil War, read on the Civil War. And I come to find out that where I'd walked down into the Sunken Road and made the left-hand turn, I walked into the exact position of John Gordon's unit, the 6th Alabama, at that time.
Wow. Have you picked up other things that, you know, would maybe a war correspondent would not have picked up about the Civil War or that particular battle that only Gordon would have known?
All this was very strange to me. You know, I wasn't a New Ager, you know, and you know, didn't play with crystals or anything like that. And I was kind of, you know, it scares you a little bit. You wonder what's going on, and here's this picture of a person that looked like you, and you know, so many years ago. And I went to a woman at the Aquarian Center in Brantford, and kind of said, "Help!" And she said, "Well, you could probably benefit from past life regression and all that." She said, "But you're a tough nut to crack. So what I'm going to do is teach you how to meditate." So she taught me how to meditate, and you know, wonderful things, the beautiful blue sky and clouds and all that stuff. And but as she was talking and everything, I'm reclining in this chair, and I get the feeling I'm on a horse. And she's saying, you know, if you see something, it's okay, and if you don't, it don't. And, but when we were finished with the session, she said, "Well, how'd it go?" I said, "You know, I had a distinct feeling that I was riding a horse. If anybody's ever ridden a horse, they, you know, that swaying back and forth, and it brought back a memory of something that happened when in the mid '60s when I was stationed at Orlando Air Force Base. I had gone with a bunch of the guys. They were going for a midnight ride to this dude ranch. I heard them making noise. It was real late at night. I said, "What are you guys doing?" They said, "We're going horseback riding." It says dark up. This is a midnight ride. So, and I went along with them. And there was quite a big group there. And the foreman of the ranch is looking around, and he's kind of like counting people and counting on his fingers and everything. I guess he's trying to figure out horses and people. And he says, "Anybody here an experienced rider?" And I shot my hand up and I said, "I am." which I wasn't at the time, because I'd ridden a horse maybe three times, and one time I thought I was going to die, so it wasn't a very pleasant experience. So I'm wondering, why did I say that? And then the guy comes over to me, kind of tilts his head and squints. He said, "Are you a good rider?" And I just looked at him and said, "Yeah, I'm good." And he turns around, walks away, and I said, "Why did I say that? That was my out." And he yells to a guy over at the barn, "Hey, bring out Rebel." So they bring out
that's
this
too good. Big, that's way too good.
Yeah, they bring out this big gray horse, and I get on it, and it's like we're Siamese twins. I think, and the horse does. I turn my toes in, and the horse turns to the left. Turn my right foot in, the horse turns to the right. I had the horse backing up, going forward. I had the horse dancing, and a lot of people say, you know, well, maybe it was a well-trained horse, and I say to them, how the hell did I know to do that stuff? But there's one of the few equestrian statues in the Georgia's on the northwest corner of the Capitol building, and it's Gordon on horseback. He was twice governor and three times senator of Georgia.
How about that? You know, getting back to the pain in your face, you went to the hospital with it. How many hours did this last? I mean, did the pain eventually go away, or did you have, you know, itching and, you know, from the healing of it, or did you have pain on the inside of your mouth from it, or?
It Well, what I was suffering was the pain of being shot through the face. I know what it feels like to be shot through the face with a musket.
Wow. How long did it last?
About 2.5-3 hours, and it finally diminished and went away, and they said, we checked you out, and you're okay. We can't find anything. And
how about that?
Home. Proof positive people, I went over to the hospital, and believe it or not, they still had the records from 1977 and when I visited, so that was just a little more evidence.
What about when you're sleeping? Do you have anything come to you when you're sleeping, like sounds or smells? You know, smells are very powerful memories. They stick with us.
Oh, yeah, triggers. Yeah, yeah. I very seldom remember my dreams, but I had one time when I was at the firehouse. It was very vivid. It was very real, but kind of cloudy, and I've got my head tilted back, and there's somebody playing with my neck, and this guy looked a lot like one of the assistant chiefs I worked with, and he's sort of like muttering, cursing, and there's like a squirt of blood and fade to black, as they say in the movie business. And when I got up in the morning, I told some of the other guys about it because they thought it was funny. I said, you know, this guy looked like John Gottfried, one of the assistant chiefs, call him Jocko. I said, and at that time, he was very much into medical things and all that. I said, what is this foreshadowing of somewhere I go and get hurt and Jocko tries to do a trait on me to save my life and ends up cutting my throat? And we had a big laugh about it. But in Gordon's book, he tells about his friend, Dr. Weathersley, who saved his life at Antietam. And Dr. Weathersley didn't think that Gordon was going to live, but he was the one that repaired Gordon's neck. So what I think I had seen was that when Gordon was wounded in Antietam, and it's Dr. Weatherly, you know, trying to work on his friend to save his life and, you know, and not having much success, but he pulled through.
That is so amazing. So amazing. Now, I guess the event that triggered all this happening was you walking into this very traumatic space that Gordon had occupied 115 years prior.
I guess some people call that what a harmonic resonance or something. I walked into the exact position of his unit where he'd been wounded 5 times that day. So, yeah, that probably did it. That started it all.
Do you think that there might have been some pre-sight to your life's work, or that perhaps this is the reason the spirit of Jeffrey Keane decided to come back at this time and in this age? Is there something that you're supposed to do in this life as the reincarnated General Gordon?
Yeah, I'm doing it right now. I'm speaking with you, and then also with the book and everything. I've done dozens of radio shows and, TV and everything. And the thing is, at first, I wasn't planning on writing a book, and then it turned into that I felt I was supposed to. And my feeling is that I'm doing exactly what I'm supposed to. And what I do in the meditations, I found out a lot of things in meditations. But it's amazing. Like the other guests you had, Richard and David Icke and all that. If you spend some time with yourself, you'd be surprised some of the things you come up with. And being a doubter most of the time, that I would get things in meditation that I wouldn't take, I take with a little grain of salt and wouldn't really put too much faith in it unless I came up with like two other validations and verifications, and that they usually were very short in coming. So I got to the point when in meditation just, saying, send me where I'm supposed to be and have me talk to the people I'm supposed to talk to and get the message to whoever's out there with the ears to hear it and so on. So I'm doing a lot of the stuff that I feel I'm supposed to be doing. People said to me, if you could go back to Gordon's lifetime and leave something, like the help with proving your case and all, what would you leave, as a little clue to find for yourself? I said, I already did it, because Gordon wrote the book in 1903. It came out a couple of months before he died, and in that book is a lot of the stuff about the men and the battles and the family and so on that just helped immensely. And I see an awful lot of parallels and just the different trips that I've taken down to the South. I threw the word coincidence out a long time ago.
Oh, yeah. Now, have you been back to Sunken Road again to see if there's the feeling still there?
Oh, I've been back quite a few times, but it didn't happen again. All it needed to do was that first time, and that was it.
Now, you mentioned about, you know, going down to the south, and I'm going to, you know, sometimes you receive things in the language that they happened in. So do you ever get, you know, that southern drawl come to your mind and it almost comes out of your mouth, or?
No, not really. But I feel like I've been guided, and I feel that things have been left for me, and other things. I've just been. I told one radio personality, I feel like I'm so guided. I feel like I've been pushed around like a shopping cart. I had picked up a book. The second book was written about Gordon, and the very first page, you said he was born in Upson County, Georgia. At a young age, moved to the northwest corner of Georgia, just outside a small town called Lafayette. I put the book down, I picked up the phone, and I called my mother. A few years previously, my parents lived in Florida, and my father had passed away, and like a lot of widows, my mother didn't want to stay in the house alone without him, and she went partners with my sister on a house, South Main Street, Lafayette, Georgia.
Oh, get out of here. Is that right?
That's right. So I said, Mom, do you have anything down there named after any Gordons or anything? She says, oh, yeah, there's Gordon Hall, there's Gordon Mill, so on. Two blocks up the street from her house is Gordon Hall. It's the oldest standing brick schoolhouse in Georgia, and it's where he attended school with his brother Chapman.
And you said, Mom, you got an extra room? I'm on my way.
Well, no, she was coming up for the summer, and I said, you know, you don't need a ride up. I'm going to come down there, and I'll bring you back. So I went down there and went over to the hall and looked around, jumped up and down. They had windows. It wasn't open to the public, and windows were high off the ground. And then there was a private home across this lot, the Marsh House, from it, and you couldn't get in there either, you know, being a private home. But so I just had to observe everything from the exterior.
Did you pick up any more similar feelings, or just a one-time connection with him? Why do you think it's just one time? Why don't you think you connect with him over and over again?
There were a lot of things connecting with him over like a 10-year period. That's how the book came about. But none of them being as dramatic as the Sunken Road. I eventually did go with a tour that went through the Marsh House, and I was up on the second floor at the base of the stairs that went to the attic, and I had kind of feeling there. You know that feeling you get through your body when you sneeze? I got that, but I got that without the sneeze, though. And my feeling was his brother and him boarded in that house when they were going to school there, so it was probably somewhere around where their room was. But another funny thing was when it was going through the tour, the lady of the house, either her or her husband are direct descendants of Gordon, and they were taking his seventh grade class through there, and I noticed under the staircase there was a cannonball and a plaque on the thing that was holding the cannonball, and it said that this was fired into Petersburg, Virginia, during the siege. And the gentleman in the house happened to be standing there, so I turned around and mentioned to him, I said, that cannonball might have been loaded by my great-grandfather, Lewis Knapp. He was with the 1st Connecticut Heavy Artillery, and he could have been the one who fired that into Petersburg. And the gentleman just looked at me and he said, oh, really? So I hurried and caught up with the rest of the group.
Jeffrey,
they're strange about that time period down there.
I'm curious because you sound like you are so on purpose that the thing that you might have been reincarnated to do was to come here and tell this story and to tell people that the universe is folded up inside of them and that we continue on and we continue to grow. Do you think we are in a critical time for humanity?
I think we're in a time, like David Icke was talking about, it's a very spiritual time. You're going to see people getting more away from the organized religion, but they may become more spiritual. There's a lot of people don't understand the difference, but there's a great difference between being spiritual and being belonging to organized religion. A lot of people that have read my story, have seen it on TV, liked it, someone, they say, you know, that's a great story, and there's the wonderful things and pictures, you know, and it's really marvelous and fascinating, but I can't believe that because of my religion.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I can't. And, you know, and a lot of times I'll say to them, well, let me ask you how you came about your religion. You know, and a lot of times they say they're Catholic and their parents were Catholic and so on. I said, so you didn't set out and check the different religions, so Judaism, Christianity, Muslimism, all that, and then pick one. This was kind of like handed to you. And they say, yeah. I said, well, if that's
a good point.
What you like, then you stay with it.
But you know, I've heard it said the difference between being religious and being spiritual is that religious people fear going to hell, and spiritual people have already been there.
Mm-hmm. Or another one I've heard was organized religion is someone else's experience with God, and spiritualism is your own experience.
Oh, that's good. I like that one, too. I like that one, too. So do you think, in your opinion, do you think it's vital to the human race that all mankind understands that what you are claiming is true and not just, you know, the ancient Eastern religions who seem to have known this forever?
Well, telling people my story, I spoke at a Civil War roundtable in Lancaster, Pennsylvania a couple of weeks ago, and a lot of times I'll start my lecture with, I'm going to tell you a story, and I'm in a very good position to tell you this story because I don't care whether you believe me or not.
Uh-huh.
What I'm going to tell you, a lot of people ask me for proof. What I'm going to tell you isn't not proof, it's evidence. I can just give you all this evidence, and I hope you have an open mind, and I hope you spend time thinking about what I say, but I want you to form your own conclusions. But I'm going to tell you this little story. And I usually play the proof positive program, my portion of it for them, and they see the photos and the polygraph and all, but you'll still have the doubters that come up that'll say
you can see people who go, now wait a minute.
Uh-huh.
If Jeffrey's story is true, then that means that everything or nearly everything that I've been taught in my church is maybe not true or maybe not entirely true. But everything that I've been taught in my church, I don't really have any proof for. I just kind of believe it because it was taught to me, and I'm told if I don't have faith in it, I'm going to go to hell. But what Jeffrey's telling me, there's evidence, and I feel his commitment to it, and I really can't argue with it. So what you've done is you've begun the awakening process of someone who was asleep, and that's powerful.
Sometimes, you know, people say you should be a little stronger with this. And I said, no, you can't force people. I would rather tickle them with a feather and get their interest than beat them over the head with a baseball bat, telling them they're wrong about the way they've been thinking.
Right, right. Well, what advice would you give someone who does a similar thing, who walks into a lot more than a deja vu, walks into the same space that they may have occupied in a past life and has a similar experience? What advice would you give them?
I've given a lot of advice on that over the years because I've been contacted by so many people. A man that's half Cree Indian up in Canada believes he had been one of Gordon's soldiers, a teenager that was killed at Antietam. Just people all over the place. And I told many people, over a decade ago, I said, you're going to see, I just had a feeling, I said, you're going to see more and more stories like mine coming in. And they're coming down the pike. There's an awful lot of them. But the best advice I give them is, my story is extremely rare in that I've never been hypnotized. That was the one thing I told the proof positive people I would not do. And they said, why not? They wanted to film a past life regression. I said, no, because all the things that I obtained, all the information I got from books, I got from myself, from meditations, I said, it's not that I don't believe in hypnosis. When I was a medic in the Air Force, I worked in a dental clinic. I saw surgery done under hypnosis and the exposure of nerves and the guy's tooth, and he didn't blink, and it was amazing. So, and I think hypnosis is a wonderful tool, but with that, it carries that stigma that people are going to say, oh, he was led, there was things implanted, and so on. So if I've never had that done, I don't have that stigma. And they said, well, your book is already out. So I said, it doesn't matter. You show me on that program having the hypnosis, and that's what people are going to remember. But I suggest that people get in touch with themselves, that they just learn to be quiet, you know, get that vibration going where they just really open themselves up to what they need to see. That's what I used to see. Show me what I need to see. And
well, you weren't in a meditative state when you walked into Sunken Road. You had a very physical reaction to this resonation. Now, how would you say that this physical feeling was different than, say, you know, an anxiety attack or a heart palpitation or indigestion? How would you say that that feeling was different? So different, in fact, that it really struck you as being profound.
I can't explain it. It's just like if somebody'd been in a plane crash and tried to explain it to you, and the only way that you're going to understand what they're talking about is if you're in a plane crash. Now, there's like three different ways I figure that you can get knowledge: intellectual knowledge through books, physical, and the emotional. Until you have all three of those, you haven't really experienced the whole thing. But in that Sunken Road, the only way I can explain it, I've told people, take the saddest you've ever been and magnify that by about 1,000 times, and that was part of that gets close to it.
But it was just a whole
bunch of things there. You can just imagine after I read about what Gordon and his men went through there, just the carnage that was going on, and you know, a lot of these people were very close and relatives, and you see people dying all around you, and you're not doing too well. You know, it's scary and so on. But I think Gordon might have been an adrenaline junkie because on the fire department, being a shift commander, you know, they asked a few times if I wanted to go up, you know, deputy chief's position, chief's position, and that becomes administrative. You know, you sit behind a desk and budget and all that, and I said no. I want the little red car to drive down the road, make the people pull over and all.
Well, so that was an experience. Even though you were a firefighter and you go into buildings that, you know, you don't know if the building's going to blow up or collapse or whatever, the feeling that you had at Sunken Road was very unique. You've never felt it before or since.
No. Nothing close to it. No.
I see. Okay. You know, I asked Richard Salva this question, and maybe I could bring it up to you. Do you think the idea that there are several billion more souls alive on Earth now than have ever lived before, do you think that we could be incarnates from other worlds as well?
Oh, sure. This isn't the only place. I figure this is a schoolroom Earth, and I think they booked us in a tough room, too. I think this has got to be one of the toughest.
But this has got to be a great time to be alive, though.
Oh, yeah. Oh yeah, it's all experience. You know, when you go through your life, what really gets to you that and helps you grow isn't the good times. Anybody can go through good times. You know, a lot of fun. You know, go to the amusement park, stuff like that. It's how you handle the bad times, those things, the stumbling blocks when they come down the road.
Yeah, I think so. And maybe even, you know, when we have the good times, it's how we handle those good times. You know, a lot of people can't handle wealth. They can't handle success.
Oh no!
It's how you handle that as well.
Yeah. Well, you hear about those horror stories of the people that win the millions and millions of dollars, and next thing you know, they're divorced and in court, and they're having the money stolen, and all the other things that go along with it.
Yeah. What is it they say about 81% of lottery winners end up filing bankruptcy?
Yep.
That is just amazing.
A lot of people have used that population on Earth thing to combat reincarnation and all, but you say to them, you know, is this the only Earth? You know, would you limit the number of stars in the sky? How many stars are there? You know, and if you start looking at those pictures from the Hubble telescope, this little blue ball that we live on is just such an insignificant little speck in those pictures.
Oh, my goodness. I was so privileged this last week to see a presentation by Stephen Bassett at the Earth Transformation Conference in Hawaii. And he gave an astronomical review on how statistically impossible it is that Earth is the only intelligent life in the universe. He went solar system to galaxy, galaxy to galaxy cluster to galaxy supercluster, and then clouds of superclusters. And that was just the known universe. If you stepped out a little ways beyond that timeline, there was another universe besides this one. The odds of this being the only world with intelligent life are about the odds of the Earth being flat and all planets and sun revolving around the Earth. It just isn't so. there is life out there. And if that life is living and dying, then it has to have spirits that that incorporate that life. And those spirits have free will and choice. And I think that they might have decided to incarnate here, where some of the greats have incarnated.
Well, the reason I go around that, you know, a lot of people say he's got a book. Well, I probably would never make a dime of profit off the book. What if the money I've spent traveling to speak about? I flew out to Colorado Springs, talked twice for free, sold 5 books, which gave me a profit of $25, and flew back home. But now I have a bill. I have a bill for $2,000.
Yeah, so, I know the feeling, my friend.
Yeah, you can only do that so many times before your bank account starts getting small.
That's right.
They say, oh, you're on TV. They think you were paid. Well, I wasn't paid to be on any of those TV programs. And actually, in one case, it cost me $600 because I had to take their release to an attorney and have him straighten it out and word it properly so I didn't lose. At that time, my book was a manuscript because it said in their standard release that they owned everything I showed them, gave them, so on. So I could have lost the rights to my book and everything by signing this thing.
Oh, yeah.
They'll shove that paper in front of you. Sign. But it said maybe standard for you, but not for this kid.
Well, I need to ask you a question, Jeffrey. You've picked up on one incarnation, and that is General Gordon. Do you think that there are other incarnations that you're picking up on? Have you received any kind of feeling from anything before that?
Oh, yeah. I picked up on the Gordon thing started the ball rolling, and that seems to be the trigger lifetime and all, and the one where all the information could be found. But I picked up things on other lifetimes, bits and pieces, samurai, Franciscan friar, Tibetan monk, an Irish girl, and so on. But I kind of played them down in the book a little bit because I wanted the people to concentrate on the strongest evidence and not say, you know, look at this guy, you know, he's all over the place. The next thing he's going to say he was Santa Claus and stuff like that. So I wanted to keep their attention and keep them riveted on the best evidence.
Yeah, but I kind of like that. I think we're all over the place. But your case, this one that you've documented, this one that you've made, such a wonderful story of, is great evidence for breaking the ice for people who have been locked in, well, what I call, you know, ignorance. They're lost in a three-dimensional cloud. They don't understand that they really are eternal beings having a mortal experience. You know, this is exactly the case you're making, and it's marvelous. It's a great eye-opener. It opens the universe to people.
I did briefly mention some of those other lifetimes, and like I told you before, when I was doing the meditations and so on, I would take it with a grain of salt. I got one on that was on a samurai lifetime, and I went and saw a couple of psychics, and I went to one psychic, and one of them came up with a lifetime as a samurai and all that, and then probably the third validation verification of this samurai thing was one of the most amazing things that ever happened to me. I was at the Borders bookstore in Stamford, Connecticut. My wife was over in the baking section. Of course, I'm over in the history section, and a gentleman came in with this woman and had this little boy. He must have been about 5 or 6 years old, maybe around more like 5, and they were down at the end of the bookshelf where I was, and the guy was trying to have the woman watch the kid so he could go off and do his thing, I guess, and the woman pulled out this big book of airplanes from World War II, I guess it was, and the little boy sitting on the floor, and he's making the plane noises and, you know, and gun noises and everything, and I'm looking at him, and a cute little tyke, and he looks up and he looks at me, but he's not really looking at me, he's like looking through me, and he says, "Samurai." And the woman says to him, "What did you say?" He says, "Samurai." "What
wow.
is that?" She said, "Where do you see that?" He said, "Nowhere. What is that?" And she starts telling him that, you know, the hair stands up on the back of my neck. And
starts
telling him it's a sword. Of course, I had to go over and correct her and say, you know, it was a person, and they carried these different swords and so on, and talked to the little boy a bit. But I looked at the end of the bookcases where he would have been looking, so on, you know, if he had said teenage ninja turtles or something, you know, like that, I, you know, I could understand that. But even if the samurai had been written out in big block letters, this child, you know, I said, oh, does he read? And they said, no, he doesn't read yet or anything. So,
I've got another child story for you. A friend of mine married a woman and adopted his son, and the son was 4 years old, and they were in, in this outdoor swimming pool, little wading pool in the outside, and they were just having fun. You know how kids' minds go, and they were splashing and having fun, and all of a sudden the kid stops and looks at him and says, you remember when I was your daddy and I used to give you rides on the big red tractor? And it just about floored him, because when he was a little boy, about 5 or 6 years old, his father used to give him rides on the big red tractor, and his dad had been dead for like 10 years. That was really amazing.
I tell people to pay attention to children, and sometimes you can catch them in off moments. I did it. I said, you can do this little trick sometime when it looks like their mind's, you know, not too much, or kind of occupied with something else. You know, you can talk to them, ask them questions. And my granddaughter one time came in and ran in to get her sneakers to go back outside, and I saw her struggling, so I went out to help her tie them. So I'm tying up the shoes. I said, were you able to tie your shoes when you used to be big? And she looked up and kind of looked off into the distance and said, yes, but they were different. And she pointed her legs. She said they were white, and they came up to here, and she started describing, you know, the old button-up shoes that they had to use the poles to tighten the laces and everything.
How
that's
about
what
that?
She was describing to me, and then all of a sudden she just stopped and said, I don't want to talk about it anymore.
Well, Jeffrey, it has been one amazing evening. I wish I could have you on more than an hour. I'm so glad that Richard introduced you to us. It has been an absolute pleasure having you here on X Squared Radio.
Well, it's been fun.
And I want to have you back again.
All righty.
All right. Thank you very much. And this is where we say goodbye, and I have to play my exit because I'm on a pretty strict schedule with my producer.
Okay. And if people go to my website, ConfederateYankee.net, they can find out where to get the book.
All right. ConfederateYankees.net.
Yes.
All right. I'm going to put that up on the archives when I post this tonight for our listeners, because tomorrow morning about 2 million people come into the office, and they plug into these archives, and they listen to this program, and they are really going to enjoy Jeffrey Keane, just like I have. Thank you so much.
All right. Thanks for having me.
Uh-huh. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right, Earth Explorers, that is it for X Squared Radio and BBS Radio Network. I will play my exit. It has been a great pleasure to have you here with us this evening. Tell a friend about it, because every Sunday evening at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, we bring you the best 3 hours of exploration into the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. If you're not getting all 3 hours, send us the call letters of your local station and we'll do the rest. Remember, Earth Explorers, that you are source. Everything we do will eventually affect the universe, so try to do it on purpose. Reach out for the good in people and help it to grow a little every day. And before long, you will have saved the planet. This is X Squared Radio saying, peace, Earth Explorers.